On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
We hear an awful lot about fake news. And to a certain extent, the 20th century was the only century in the history of journalism that the attempt was made to not be biased in reporting. But nonetheless, bias creeps in, and with the multiplicity of platforms, it's really difficult to know what's the truth. And even more so, if you're a Christian, the idea of truth becomes a critical component. So we're delighted to welcome to On the Bookshelf today, Rachel Whiteman, who is a librarian, educator, and a believer in integrating faith and fact-checking. She is the Associate Director for Instruction and Outreach at Concordia University at St. Paul. Before moving to Minnesota in 2012, she served as a librarian and missionary in Uganda. So Rachel is not somebody that just has a theory about how this works. Rachel has had an opportunity to be out in the field, and as a librarian has the opportunity to interact with all sorts of people who are looking for answers. Her new book is Faith and Fake News, A Guide to Consuming Information Wisely. It's from William B. Erdman's Publishing Company. So thank you very much for making time to talk to us today on the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me. I love talking about this topic, so thanks for inviting me.
Did you feel like you needed to write a book to address this? Was it because of all the questions that you have of people coming into the library and saying, well, how do I find out what's really true? Or are these people telling me the truth? Or do I need to be more discerning and so forth? What led you to that?
It actually came out of an interesting way that I was able to integrate sort of some of my vocation and my career with my faith community. I had the idea back in 2019 to offer a class at my church on sort of how to find information. And I do that all the time as a librarian, right? I help people find information. You know, a lot of times people think librarians are just like shushing people and reading books, but we're not doing either. Usually we're helping people navigate online spaces and find information and help them figure out what's credible and what's not. And I felt like I had a lot of skills that could be helpful at my church, at my faith community, because so many of those folks in my life were also asking similar questions around, like, how do I engage with the news? How do I have conversations with people about the news? How do I know what's true? How do I know who an expert is? And so I started offering workshops for churches in 2020, and which of course was an ironic time to be doing that, helping churches really navigate and reflect on how do you find information online, and how do you really integrate that into your faith and be more discerning and wise and kind online. And so I offered these workshops, and then out of that, I was really excited to have the opportunity to write this book, because I wanted to be able to help people more than I can do in just these sessions I was doing. And it really allowed me to go deeper into some topics and to provide, one of the things that's really important to me is to provide opportunities for like a deeper reflection and more intentionality and mindfulness online. And I was able to do that in the book by providing exercises and practice questions and discussion questions to really give people an opportunity to think a little bit deeper about these spaces that are often vying for our attention and often very quick things, right? We are kind of sucked into social media because we can keep scrolling and there's all these quick videos. And so I was hoping my book could provide a space to allow people to be a little bit more intentional and also find those things that are true, help them navigate the things that are confusing.
It occurs to me as a journalist and a radio guy for many, many years that one of the problems with the internet is there's not a filter, so to speak. In other words, if you are writing a news story and you work for a radio or TV station or a newspaper or magazine, you generally have an editor to whom you take your story and your pictures and say, this is what I've got, and I think this would work. I think this would be something that people need to know about. And they would, having had many, many years of experience, take a look at it and try to analyze it and try to figure out, have you managed to avoid bias in it, and are you using credible sources, and have you double-checked your sources, and all of those journalistic rules that keep us on the straight and narrow. But with the internet, it's the wild, wild west. Anybody can post anything about anything. And if we're not careful, we're hearing something and thinking that it is a genuine report, and it may not necessarily be. You bring up a couple of things. For example, there's a difference between, you say, misinformation and disinformation, that one is something that's out of context or incorrect. The other is intentional false information. This is one of the dangers of relying on the internet without any sort of help figuring out what's reality, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think that you described it so well. Like, historically, you know, journalism and all these organizations, there were so many more things in place that helped us kind of gate check, like you said, and make sure things weren't just going out that were crazy. Of course, false information has always been around,
right?
But I do think there were a lot more checks and balances, and now we have the internet, which is great in one sense, right? We can look all kinds of things up. Everyone has access to so much more information, but with that comes also more opportunity for misinformation and more opportunity for people to create disinformation purposely so. And so, yes, I think you described it exactly right, and I think that is my hope as a librarian, is to help people start to evaluate what they're seeing. You know, sometimes people joke with me that, like, libraries are going to go away because everything's online, and I like to say that librarians are actually, like, our goal should be to help people navigate more. Like, we are more needed now to help people navigate all of those things that they're seeing that are really overwhelming.
I would say that most people don't realize how really complicated the internet is. And I have to admit that I really didn't know either. I mean, to me, it just seemed like this magical place arose and we could find all this information. We discovered that we no longer need to buy encyclopedia sets or thesaurus or dictionaries, because all that information is available online. Translator apps that help us to translate from one language to another, so that we don't even have to learn another language. We can just use an app for it. Just seems pretty extraordinary. Most of us have no idea just how huge it is. In the book, you say that there is 79 trillion gigabytes of information as of 2021. And so there's more now because it's 2 years later. That's just an almost unimaginable amount of information.
Yeah, it's amazing how much we have access to. You know, if you have access to a smartphone or a computer, a laptop, we just have access to so much more information than historically was available. And on the flip side, some of that is not, I talk about this in the book as well, some of that is not freely available. And I'm also an advocate for saying, like, sometimes we need to pay for the good information, right? Good journalism. It's okay. It's good to get a subscription to a quality newspaper, right? Like, let's pay the people for their good work. And so I think that there is also this misconception that because so much is available online, it's all free. And that's just not the case. And if we only rely on what is free, I think we miss out on a lot of information.
Another thing that you point out in the book is you discuss the information landscape, and you talk about algorithms and that algorithms sometimes create what are called filter bubbles, which means filter bubbles are when we only learn the stuff that we kind of already agree with.
Yeah, exactly. So a lot of our online spaces, whether we're on social media like Facebook or Instagram or TikTok, or if we're just searching on Google, these platforms are collecting data on us, and they are kind of saying, like, oh, you've clicked on this a bunch of times, so maybe you want to see more of that. Sometimes this is also called personalization. And, you know, if you do a search where you are and I do a search, we probably get different things because we're in different locations. And so everything is very highly personalized, which creates this sort of bubble or echo chamber where, because these platforms keep showing us the things related to what we've clicked on in the past, it's trying to predict more of that in the future, and it can definitely create spaces where we see different things, we live in different realities, and I think that's a really important thing for us to understand in our culture that feels so divided right now. I really wonder and kind of posit in my book that some of that is coming from the different realities that we're seeing online and the different information that we're engaging with. And I don't know if we always think about that, you know, when we're having those conversations with our family and friends and we disagree, I don't know if we always think through, like, well, where did they get that information? And maybe we're literally seeing different things. And so my hope is really that people would start to think about that and to be curious and ask their friends and family, where do you get your information from? And start to be able to get outside of our normal echo chambers and maybe start engaging with some different perspectives.
There is a kind of a joke that's around these days that if you learned it from the internet, well, that you can trust it because it's on the internet. And then we laugh because we realize that there's all kinds of stuff on the internet, as you say in the book. For example, if on some place you gave away the data that you had been, say, a Boy Scout like me, amazingly enough, after a while, things will start to pop up in the ads on Facebook, say, that might be things that you would be interested in if you like to go camping or and so forth. And it does the same thing on Instagram, all of the social platforms. All of a sudden, things will start to show up when you've given away some data about your life. You'll start to get things that are, because the algorithms are not just to make you interested in new things, it's to make you buy new things. And the algorithms figure out, okay, if you're into that, you might want to buy this.
Yeah, so many things are related to advertisements and companies that they want to make money, right? And so they're finding ways to do that. And yeah, exactly. They take what we've done in the past, whatever we've clicked on, searched for, scrolled past, all of those things, wherever we are, and they kind of take that and kind of make guesses about what we'd like to see in the future, which is usually more of the same.
Now, you define a lot of things. First of all, you talk about how really enormous the internet is and that it's not just a network like NBC or something. It's all these other things that all merge into it from one place or another, and that's why there's so much information. And you define some words that, particularly for people who remember the days before computers and before the internet, you explain some of the things, some of these phrases that get tossed around by people who've grown up using the internet. Would you mind taking a moment to explain what are websites, what are apps, what are social media, search engines, browsers, what do all that stuff mean?
Yeah, that was really important to me, was to make sure that, like, in my book, I was defining those terms, because they all, like you said, they all get kind of tossed around, but we don't always have clear understanding. Websites are, you know, the static pages that we look at, not static, but they're online, where we say, like, oh, I'm going to go to, like, the New York Times website, or, you know, I work at Concordia University, so I might go to my university's website. And those are the pages where we, or maybe it's a website for a store that we like, right? Like, Target headquarters are here, so I'm, you know, across the street from a Target right now. So, like, maybe I want to look at the Target website. And then other things that we use regularly are those apps. So on a smartphone, we can download an application, and sometimes they're related in the sense that, like, I can download a Target app and I can buy things that way. I can also download social media apps where I can, like, engage with people and content on social media, like Facebook and Instagram and TikTok. Those are all apps where I can go, but they're also websites. And that's where it gets so confusing, is, like, I can go to the Facebook website or I can go to the Facebook app. And they're very similar, but in other cases, they're not always the same. And so, yeah, I was trying to really define some of those things. Our search engines are things like mostly Google at this point, but certainly Bing, or there's another one called DuckDuckGo that are also search engines that search across all of those websites for us. In the library, of course, we have something called databases, which is like a search engine, searching across scholarly information. And so it can get really confusing, because we do have so many different ways to access information. I can go to the New York Times website. I can download the New York Times app. I can follow the New York Times on social media. And so it can get kind of complicated. And I think it was also important for me to help people start realizing that these are all different places and separate, even though we might not always see them that way.
We're talking, in case you're just joining us, to Rachel Whiteman, who is the author of Faith and Fake News, A Guide to Consuming Information Wisely, from William B. Erdman's publishing company. This is interesting. You have an example of fake news from the first century, from the time of Jesus' resurrection, and it's in Matthew 28. You want to tell us about this early example of fake news?
Yeah, it was so interesting. I had the opportunity to be on a podcast, and it was a partnership between Love Thy Neighborhood and the Holy Post podcast, and they talked about this story, and I mentioned it in the book as well. It was so cool to me to hear this on the podcast after I helped record part of it. I only recorded a small part of it, but then they talked about this story, and I hadn't really thought about it before as fake news, but they described how after Jesus rose from the dead and his body was missing, how, you know, it was reported to the religious leaders, his body is missing, and how they perpetrated fake news by saying, well, don't tell anyone what happened. Don't tell anyone that his body is gone. And I just think, it's so important for us in this world where we can feel like fake news or misinformation feels so urgent. And it's certainly an important issue. I think it's so helpful to remember that this is not new. And certainly it's been a part of our, for those of us who are Christians, it's been part of our faith tradition. And yet looking for the truth is also so important. And so, realizing the historical pieces of it is helpful to know, this isn't new. I think in that podcast, they also talk about at the end of the day, God is on his throne. The kingdom of God is breaking in. And so we can still be, encouraged that in the midst of all of this misinformation from the beginning of our faith,
yes.
up until now, there is still truth that is breaking in, and we can be part of that as well.
You also talk about specific types of content that you suggest that we fact check, and I'm just going to run through the list, and then you tell us more about them. About memes, about quotes from leaders that are out of context or have no context, or sound bites that have no context, emotional-sounding headlines, hot-button social issues, and images. And in some cases, these are images that have been manipulated in some way or the other, which we used to call fake photos. Well, how do we watch out for this stuff? You've got some really excellent suggestions as to how we avoid being taken in by these things. And it basically boils back down to what, in a sense, what a good journalist does in order to make sure a story is true.
Yeah, I think, there's so many times where it's important for us to slow down and to just check what we're reading or hearing or seeing. I think a lot about how much information we have available. And I think that doing a little bit of fact checking, I'm not a proponent of saying we have to fact check everything. I think that would be exhausting, and we wouldn't have the opportunity to engage with anything. But I do think that especially the piece about things that feel emotional or make us very emotional, I think they're worth double checking, because so much content, like you said before, is really driving towards encouraging us to buy something and to have this emotional experience so that we engage with the content. Fact checking and saying, well, that seems too good to be true, so maybe I should double check if it actually happened, or if something makes us really angry, double checking and saying, do I have all the sides of the story on this? You read off on that list, some of those other things like images, sometimes we're seeing that right now in the news regularly about images that can be doctored and changed. And so doing a little bit more to say, is this actually true? And it doesn't take a whole lot. Usually just a quick Google search will often get you the other side of the story or a different viewpoint, and knowing how to use that, and to do those searches can be really helpful. I also mentioned using fact-checking websites like Snopes or PolitiFact, and those can be another good way to just to see what else are people saying about this little clip that we heard on the radio, or this one headline. Is there something else there? And I think that can be really helpful to use tools. People are already doing the fact checking, so we can take advantage of that. And good fact checkers will cite their sources for us, so we don't have to find it as much. So I think taking advantage of all the work people are already doing in those ways is really, really important.
In here, you talk about something that librarians at Penn State libraries developed a framework called If I Apply, if I can share this. These are personal steps, I identify emotions attached to topic, F, find unbiased references sources for proper review of topic, I, intellectual courage to seek authoritative voices on a topic that may be outside of our comfort zones, and then the source steps, apply, A, for authority established, P, purpose point of view of the source, P, publisher, does the publisher have an agenda, L, list of sources, a bibliography, and Y, year of publication, which reminds us to check because things change. Despite some people who say, oh, the science is set. No, science is never set. That's why it's called science. History is set, pretty much, but science is not. So it matters if you read something that was written in 1900 that claims one particular truth. It might be very, very different in 2023 because in the meantime, there's been a great deal of scientific research and old kinds of opinions about things have been discredited. 150, 160 years ago, people thought diseases were caused by bad smells. And so the way to avoid getting sick was to avoid bad smells. They didn't know about germs. It matters that you check to make sure that the people that are writing things that you're reading actually know what they're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. Checking the creator's credibility and what kind of credentials do they have. And exactly to your point, like, is what you're looking at current in the field that you're looking at, right? It really matters. I think of, like, the beginning days of the COVID pandemic and how the science was changing so rapidly. And it was hard to keep up with, but that's the goal of science, like you said, is to keep learning.
You also mentioned, and I don't remember if we said this or not, but I think it's really important. So if we mentioned it, it's worth mentioning again, to find original sources. This is a great way to discover if a photograph has been altered, for example. And these things happen. People want to make a statement, and they say, well, I don't have a good photograph that shows what, you know, is not a great example, but I have a similar photograph, so maybe if I jockey around with a little bit, use Photoshop and put some things in or take some things out, it'll be just right. And if I could find this photograph, that'd be great. But if I can't find it, I'll make it. And that's a very dangerous path to go down. So looking for original sources can help you discern if something has been manipulated like that.
Yeah, exactly. I always encourage everyone, like, go back to the original if you can. Again, we can't always take the time to do that, but if we can, same thing with like a part of a speech, right? Like, let's read the whole speech or get the full context. Go to that original speech instead of just taking the sound bite that you heard or that was mentioned in a news story. So yeah, definitely the original source, the original image, the original story, as much as we can to get back to the heart of what's going on.
So is there something else that you wanted me to ask you that I have not asked you about?
Oh, I can't think of anything.
Oh, okay. Then to wrap it up, when you do these classes and these seminars, you wrap it up by talking about, if you're a Christian, how do you do all this? How do you purposely seek out new perspectives? How do we love our neighbors, even if we think our neighbors have bad ideas or bad opinions, particularly based on posts on Facebook or something? At the end of the day, what do we need to do to be true to our faith in Christ and be wise consumers of what's out there on the internet?
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, my hope is that by giving people the tools to understand the information landscape, like we talked about, and tools to do a little bit of that fact-checking, you know, as we grow in those areas, my hope is that we are able to then have more productive and careful and kind conversations with our friends and family and our neighbors. At the end of the day, I think all of this is about relationships. And as people of faith, we want to love people well. And so by learning and having these tools and being able to engage maybe with the truth, but also kindly, my hope is that we can actually be about having good relationships with the people around us that are caring and yes, focus on the truth and also hopefully more productive and more kind and can really be more focused on who we are as Christians and not on all of the things we could be arguing about, but really about loving our neighbors really well.
It's an exceptionally useful book. It's not real long, but it's got an awful lot of information in it that most people, particularly those over a certain age, probably are not aware of just how vast the internet is and how it works. And for us, I think this is particularly important to read. But and of course, if you're a journalism professor out there, this is a really good book that would be really useful to use in a class, especially if you're at a seminary, I'm thinking. But it's got plenty of truth in it, so it would be good for even secular universities to in their journalism departments to use. Now, is Concordia University, are you also related to the Concordia Seminary in St. Louis?
Yes. We're the Concordia University St. Paul is part of the Concordia University system with the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod.
Yes. I knew that because I grew up Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Even though I wasn't a Lutheran pastor, my Lutheran background informs me. And so I wanted to be sure that we mentioned that. So, Rachel, thank you so much. Do you want people to check out your website or your podcast or anything like that? If so, how do they do that?
Yes, that would be great. So my website is rachelihwhiteman.com, and you can listen to any of the podcasts I've been on there. And then I also try regularly to post on Instagram at faithful.factchecking, just tips and things that I'm noticing in the world around us as it relates to faith and engaging online.
Okay, so Instagram, it's faithful.factchecking, and
correct.
Website is Rachel L. Whiteman, that's W-I, no H, at that point anyway, W-I-G-H-T-M-A-N.
Yeah, it's actually Rachel I. Whiteman.
Right, yes, I'm sorry, I forgot the I, yep. And that's important. Rachel I. Whiteman, that's I, like initial I, not like
yes.
I that you see with. Okay.
Yes.
Okay, an important distinction there. All right, Rachel, thank you so much for making time to talk to us, and thanks for a terrific book. It really is a wonderful tool.
Thank you so much for having me, and thanks so much for engaging with this material.
Absolutely. Our thanks once again to Rachel Whiteman, the author of Faith and Fake News, A Guide to Consuming Information Wisely from William B. Erdman's Publishing Company. She is a librarian, educator, and believer in integrating faith and fact-checking, the Associate Director for Instruction and Outreach at Concordia University and Concordia Seminary in St. Paul, Missouri. And she also served as a librarian and missionary in Uganda prior to moving to Minnesota. Thanks so much for joining me. We'll be back next week with more interesting information from interesting authors. So I appreciate them making time to talk to us, and I appreciate you listening to it. You can check out my podcast at onthebookshelf.podbean.com. And also check out WTBFradio.com, where our podcasts are also archived. Until next week, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.